Nice to have you back, Matt.
Thanks for having me back, Nima.
And let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East. We had a new assassination in Lebanon. And this was a huge impact on Hezbollah. Nobody can ignore that because we know how important Nasrallah was for Hezbollah. When he came into power in 1992, he had 23 years old. And he just revolutionized the way that Hezbollah was working and just expanding everything in every aspect that they were doing, they were their activities. And right now, by this assassination, in your opinion, what was the main goal in their mind, in the mind of Netanyahu and his administration? Because we've seen what has happened to Ismail Haniyeh, and after that we had Yahya Sinwar in power right now as the head of Hamas. It didn't change that much the movement, the objectives of these groups. But right now, with this assassination, in your opinion, what did they want to achieve?
Well, it was the spectacle of it. It was the celebration of the act itself, Nima. Occurs the same day that Netanyahu gives his speech at the UN General Assembly. I mean, so at the same time as he's giving that speech, saying how he wants peace and that, as well as calling the United Nations an anti-Semitic swamp, you know, he goes on to his Air Force is getting ready to carry out those bombings. You know, I mean, so the spectacle of it, certainly there are great implications for Hezbollah losing, many members of its leadership. I mean, impressive how thorough the Israelis were in executing this. But that's all short term, as well as to the utilization of terror. So dropping, as I understand it, at least 170,000 pounds of bombs to try and get Nasrallah and other top commanders in the midst of a very built-up area of South Beirut. I mean, so it really comes down to just the idea that the act, again, while it has an effect on Hezbollah, of course, but that effect will be short-term. They'll replace their leadership, even Nasrallah. They will get their operations back synced and in line. The effect is mainly a punitive one. It's an act of public vengeance. It's revenge. And I think in many ways it serves as a warning to others in the region. Hey, Sudani, you don't think we'll kill you in Baghdad? As well as it's a message to the Israeli people themselves that with October 7th anniversary coming up in less than a week now, here's Netanyahu's act of atonement, Nasrallah's head on a platter. And so it serves for the internal political purposes of Israel just as much as it serves any other purposes.
And it's so amazing, Matt, when I consider what has happened during this new election in Iran. We had the new president in Iran. In his inauguration, we had the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. Mm-hmm. And right now, when he was in New York, the new assassination happening in Lebanon. Do you think that is there anything going on with the new government in Iran and Washington that may have influenced the process of this type of mindset on the part of Israeli government? Because it seems to me, the way that I look at these events, I think that they're doing everything to make troubles for the new government in Iran. And it seems, because it didn't work for Hamas. They know it doesn't work for Hezbollah. And we had, these are 10,000, more than 10,000 people, these are huge institutions, civilian institutions and military institutions. They cannot influence them the way that we saw the Hezbollah. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was just so important for the entity, for this organization. But it's a political party as well. Yeah. But when it comes Let's put it this way. When it comes to the government at Iran, do you think, is there anything in Washington in terms of the relationship between the new government in Iran, the Zarif team, who came into power right now, who did that agreement between Iran and the United States, which was so important, and we know that Netanyahu was totally against that agreement. Mm-hmm. And what do we know about these things?
I think you bring up a really interesting point and a possible aspect of what's going on here. If the Iranians and Americans are doing their best not to go to war with each other within their own political constraints, right? So they can't show their hand in this. But if both sides, as you know, we can expect, are saying to one another, I don't want to go to war with you, you don't want to go to war with me, it'd be disastrous for us both, let's avoid it, and try and not do anything to further accelerate our possibility of going to war with each other. That means in terms of what kind of restraint can you hold on your proxies or on your allies, however you want to term them. So Iran obviously seems, if this is the case, and Iran is holding back Hezbollah from significant escalation in this. And I say that, you know, I think most people are asking right now, where are the 150,000 rockets and missiles and drones, including hypersonic missiles, that Hezbollah supposedly has? You know, and so is it that, you know, a couple of different reasons for that. You know, Israel's attack these last week and a half, starting with the Pager attacks. When we were talking last week, the Israeli Air Force was conducting the largest bombing raids in their history against Lebanon. And then, of course, we've had the attacks since Friday and all through now. You know, more than 150 Lebanese were killed in the last 24 hours from bombing. You know, that there is the very likelihood that, one, maybe they don't have all these weapon systems. Maybe the Hezbollah's military capacity has been exaggerated. There's another aspect that, you know, very likely they are in disarray right now and they're not able to act to launch attacks in any meaningful manner. They have fired rockets and missiles across the border into Israel, but, you know, nothing like the response we would expect. And then the third aspect, you know, of several, you know, it is there part of a larger plan, or are they working in concert with other nations, most especially Iran, in terms of trying how not just to respond to Israel, but to manage events going forward, to lead them to a goal or lead them to a place that they want to get to. And so it's possible that Iran is executing that type of restraint on Hezbollah, saying, look, we know you're upset, we know you want revenge, but you need to hold back for reasons A, B, and C. And we should note that many Iranians have been killed in this, both their diplomatic officials and their military. There have been at least a couple Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps generals who have been killed in the last week in Lebanon. You know, Iran certainly, too, is feeling this. The Americans, though, cannot put that type of restraint on Israel for reasons no other than, you know, no other reasons than the American elections. The United States could not put any restraint on Israel. You know, the obvious restraint is right there. The clear and apparent leverage is right there. All the military support the United States gives to Israel. We just gave Israel $8 billion more in the last week. You see this unevenness where maybe there is this dynamic occurring where the Iranians and the Americans are saying, yeah, we really don't want this to go to war. And they're, you know, the idea that they can try and restrain their allies, their proxies, is real on the Iranian side and just a political fabrication on the American side.
And what's so amazing right now is how the Biden administration is functioning, because it doesn't seem, I haven't seen any president in the history of the United States being that much ineffective in the way that he's just handling the situation with Israel. What's happening, Matt, right now in the United States? Because even with Donald Trump, we hadn't this type of attitude on the part of Israelis.
Well, there certainly is a lot of anger and frustration in my part of the country. You go a few hours west from me, you get to the Appalachians, you get to the Smoky Mountains, you get to the Blue Ridge Mountains. And of course, that's where Hurricane Helene came through. And, you know, in my state in North Carolina, the western part of the state, you know, one of our biggest cities is not going to have water back on. They're saying for a month, maybe longer. Everyone I know out there has lost their power, their cell phone service, and their water service. And roads and bridges are destroyed, on and on and on. 100 people have been killed, 600 are still missing. And I think the anger and the frustration, because what people know is that they're going to get shortchanged, that the U.S. government is not going to provide the relief and the assistance necessary for the people of Florida, for Georgia, for South Carolina, and for North Carolina and Virginia as necessary or as needed as there should be. We just had this occur back in August. We might have talked about this because it had been the 1 year anniversary of the wildfires that destroyed much of the Hawaiian island of Maui. And at that point, the folks in Hawaii were saying we need $12 billion to recover from this. And the United States federal government has provided about $3 billion so far, right? But, you know, $12 billion was essentially the amount of money that the U.S. Congress appropriated to Israel back in April. We just gave the Israelis $8 billion. We just gave the Ukrainians $8 billion. U.S. Congress appropriated $60 billion for Ukraine, five times as much as they've, oh no, more, well, more than five times, 20 times as much and more as they have given Maui, for Maui to rebuild. And again, Maui needs, the federal government's only provided about a quarter of what those folks are saying. So there's a lot of anger here in the United States, seeing this, seeing the money go overseas, seeing that trade-off of the financing the American empire and its role in its works abroad versus neglecting people here at home. Because people also don't understand, it's not just the direct money, right? The Ukraine's getting X, Israel's getting Y, North Carolina will get what's ever left over, or, you know, and there won't be anything left over. It's also to the understanding that all these resources that are put into the American empire, particularly into its military and war machine, are resources that are not provided here at home. So the idea that we just don't have the people who can fulfill these roles, who can go and do the operations to rescue and to rebuild and reconstruct, we don't have. We've chronically underfunded state and federal government so that in terms of times of emergency and in rebuilding process, they simply don't have the people to facilitate what's needed. You also see that with the infrastructure, too, that we're not strengthening our infrastructure. One, it's going to cost, hundreds of billions of dollars to recover from the storm, particularly when you factor in the economic losses, right? Businesses that are lost, people who aren't being paid as well, too. There's all these other aspects that come from a storm like this that people understand. You know, how many banks and corporate landlords out there are going to tell their folks, in the path of this hurricane, don't worry about your mortgage payment this month. Oh, you can let this rent payment slip. I mean, so there's all these factors that go into these natural disasters, which are, of course, because of climate change, increasing in their frequency and strength. But the idea is that we're putting the money that can be being utilized to strengthen, make the United States more resilient. Certainly the infrastructure we have not been keeping up to make it resilient to such extreme things of weather and severe types of weather. But then, the idea that money is being put into the American war machine, $1 trillion a year, essentially 800 overseas bases and overseas wars. So $175 billion so far to the Ukraine war. About $25 billion so far to the Israel war, the genocide in Gaza, and now this war in Lebanon. So I think that's the mood among the people here in the United States, and you're seeing that build. And among the candidates, of course, everything to do to police Israel, don't upset the lobby. And of course, the Democrats, though, that Harris, the White House, as well as the Harris campaign, terrified that, and this is why their prime interest in not going to war is, with Iran because they're scared to death that that will cause a major economic shock, an oil shock, and that, you know, gas in the United States will be $8 a gallon. And that, of course, will cost Harris the presidency. So, of course, after November 5th, after the election, that calculation gets greatly diminished. So at that point, you let the Israeli lobby get what they want. So that's essentially what I see, the, you know, both the public and the political attitudes on these wars.
And the other thing is that they're trying, it seems that trying to do an offensive on the ground in the southern part of Lebanon. And Hezbollah was talking about that. We are prepared. You can come in. And how do you see the situation right now? Do you think they're going to go on the ground? That would be, and at the end of the day, I don't understand why they're doing this. To be honest, I don't get it. And I don't know what's the necessity of going on the ground in Lebanon. And what was, let's put it aside, the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah. But what's in it for them?
Certainly the politics of this have proved well for Benjamin Netanyahu. Yeah, he's still, you know, the hundreds of thousands that were on the street in 2023 demanding he resign. Certainly they came back out, particularly in late summer of 2024. There was protests, I think, on Friday as well in Tel Aviv. The idea that most of those protests are not for peace, though. They are for getting the hostages back at whatever price, but as long as they get them back. And then, of course, they're just politically against Netanyahu as well. Very similar to how there's just a lot of evidence that while there were a lot of really good, strong, anti-war principled folks in the American protests against the Iraq War in opposition to the Iraq War in 2003, the many of those within that movement were purely motivated by their dislike for George W. Bush. And that, you know, so the same thing occurring with those protests in Israel. Now, what we've seen with the polling numbers out there is we've seen that this has been very good for Benjamin Netanyahu and Likud, that if they were to go have elections today, they would have 25 or 26 seats. So they would be ahead of their nearest rival by 7 or 8 seats. You know, so, and that's dramatically improved from a few months ago where Likud was only expected to get maybe 19 or 20 seats. So by not by any means a perfect situation for Netanyahu, but probably a better situation than he was in politically a year ago. You know, I mean, so the idea, too, is that October 7th is coming up, and the best way to get people to not talk about or to forget about the disaster of October 7th. And then this slaughter in Gaza, which, you know, is just exhausting Israel. The Israelis are going to spend about $120 billion on their war in Gaza this year. That's, you know, essentially like 15 or 20% of their GDP. You know what I mean? So it's massive what this cost is. And it's just a bloodlust that's being fulfilled. And so with this new bloodlust in Lebanon, you have this opportunity for Netanyahu next week when people want to talk about October 7th to show them, you know, continue to show them Nasrallah's head on a platter. The idea of a ground invasion is just, you know, for most of us, this is absurd. You know, the only time, two times you can say the Israelis have been defeated were in their two invasions of Lebanon. You know, the first one was in 2000, 18 years after their occupation began, but then again in 2006. And who was the guy who beat him both times? It was Nasrallah. So, I mean, certainly you understand that relationship then between the Israelis and the Shia Lebanese. The idea of a ground invasion, though, to us seems so ludicrous, right? You know, this and it should be, I think, your show and other shows, you should have a subtitle, Nima, that says, you know, Nima asks his guests to rationally, logically explain the irrational and the craven. You know, I mean, like the questions we have to try to explain why these people are doing this. And, you know, with Netanyahu, we have in person, you know, Nixon's madman strategy. Nixon and Kissinger, for people who aren't familiar with that, had this idea of the madman theory, the madman strategy, that if you act so crazy, you're going to scare your opponent and they're going to back down because they can't trust you to do anything that's logical or wise or reasonable. So if you act crazy enough, well, you know, the Chinese and the Russians will stop supporting the Vietnamese because maybe Nixon just won't drop an A-bomb on Hanoi, but will drop one, you know, in Vladivostok. Yeah, I mean, so like that type of strategy, that theory is personified, has been born, you know, carried out through Netanyahu. So the idea of trying to predict what he's going to do, certainly, again, the idea of going in doesn't make any sense. The idea of going in limited and you're just going to be there for a month or 6 months or whatever you lie to yourself about, that's not going to work. Ask anyone who's invaded any place how easy it is to get out of something, you know, once they've occupied it. You're also then, too, you're playing right into Hezbollah's strength. That's what Hezbollah wants. They want you to come in close. They want to be able to get, you know, they don't want you keeping them at arm's reach. They want to get in close and fight you that way. And that would also, too, mean that maybe these rumors that we're hearing about Yemenis and Iraqis and Syrians coming to fight with Hezbollah, just as Hezbollah went and fought with you know, the Syrians in their civil war, you know, that makes those rumors very important. I mean, if you do, say you get an extra cadre of 30,000, 40,000 battle-tested, combat-experienced, competent fighters from Iraq, Syria, Yemen, organized under competent, capable, and experienced leaders, you get 20, 30, 40,000 of them in southern Lebanon. What does that do? And then the idea, too, that the Israeli economy and army can keep this up. The Israeli army is exhausted. They've scaled back their ground operations per se as well in Gaza, and they transferred those troops up north, and they've mobilized reservists again. Something like 300,000, just to give an idea of people what this means in terms of the stress on their society and their economy. The Israelis have called up for duty 300,000. You know, some have been for short durations. Some have been on duty this whole time. But 300,000 is the number. They've only got, 8 million people, total population? When you strip out the senior citizens, strip out those who are in school, strip out the children, strip out those who are unable to work, you know, what's your population size then, right? So you're calling up 300,000 people out of your working population. What's that, about 10% maybe even more of your workforce is getting pulled out? I mean, so this is one example of the Israeli economy and their society struggling with this. So you're going to exasperate that. You're going to, you know, extenuate it. But again, politically, it's good for Netanyahu. So, you know, he's got to do something. He put himself out there, Nima, and this is where I think he made a mistake. I understand why he said, Israelis back into their homes, getting settlers back into their homes in the north of Israel, why he made that a priority, why he made that a pledge, why he made that as a goal when he so clearly linked the war against Hamas with the war against Hezbollah, so the war against the Palestinian people with the war against the Lebanese people. You know, he made that, I understood why he made that. There was a reason for it. But now you've seen the danger of that, right? We're now, how is that? Is he just going to forget about it, make pretend he never said it? Or, you know, because if he doesn't do something to get those settlers back in, this is a clear metric that he's failed upon. And how much grace time, how much all the other things about destroying Hamas, and we've destroyed 21 or 24 Al-Qassam battalions, you know, on and on, all that stuff. That's fungible. And that's all wordplay. But when you say we're going to get our settlers back into their homes in northern Israel, there's a very clear metric for that. There's a very weird way to figure out if that's true or not. Are they back in their homes? So maybe, you know, this invasion, again, he's got the political support behind him. He's got this idea of the greater destiny creating, you know, which is the destiny of greater Israel, which gets the reactionary religious right on his side on this. The idea of a buffer zone in Lebanon and really finally taking it to Hezbollah and giving them what they deserve. You know, he gets the militarist nationalist sides on him. And they go up there. And then, from there, is it a redo of 06 or is it much longer like 82? But again, you look at this and you say, I just don't see how this doesn't end in disaster or expanding the war. But then, of course, you have to remember that there's no goal for Israel other than the war itself. For this administration, this regime in Israel, the only goal is the war. That's how they stay in power, right? And it fulfills their historical understanding of themselves, both in the modern era and in their biblical era, as warriors who are surrounded by a hostile population of barbarians, unbelievers, subhumans, etc. So it fits with that motif. And it keeps the crisis going so that the American Congress is constantly has Israel at its attention. It's constantly being brought to them and they're constantly approving more and more money. And so, you look at it that way and, maybe trading off. It's important to understand the casualties in Gaza for the Israelis. At one point, they were suffering about 1,000 casualties, most of that wounded. But then what happened is you realize that those numbers were what were piled together. So if you actually look at the month by month numbers, you see that majority of the casualties Israel has sustained in their war against Hamas and their genocide in Gaza occurred on October 7th. So they've had 750 soldiers killed. About 400 of those were killed on October 7th. And with the casualty numbers, it's even higher. They've had 2,500 wounded in Gaza since October 7th. And on October 7th, they have 4,000 wounded. So when you look at, when you're able to get those numbers, the casualty numbers on Israel and pull them apart, you can see that their casualties are not as dramatic as maybe we thought they were. But it's still a pressure. It's still a stress, both on the army and on the public. Again, this is a reserve army that's used to being at home. They're not used to being called up like this, not used to suffering these types of casualties. It's also an Israeli military that hasn't really suffered casualties since 06. From 06 up until, 2023, the Israeli army, most of their practice was in shooting kids with rocks, best exemplified by the great March of Return in 18 and 19. So, you pull all these things out, you just realize that for the Israelis, the best thing to do is just to keep doing what you're doing now, expand it, find new areas, but because that's what's most successful for us. And we'll struggle through with our army, we'll struggle through with our society, and we'll struggle through with our economy. And hopefully there's not a collapse. And hopefully this idea of a civil war that people keep bringing up doesn't come true. But if you got God on your side, why shouldn't you be able to get through that?
And the question right now is how this assassination would influence the Hezbollah internally. And because these people who are coming to the power are people who have experienced the battlefield on the ground, firsthand experience. In Syria, in Iraq, in anywhere, they had a lot of fight against Daesh, against ISIS. Mm-hmm. And these people are younger, new generation compared to those one who were assassinated by Israel. And these new ones, how would do you see their influencing their changing the attitude of Hezbollah?
Well, certainly, I think you're going to have a more aggressive Hezbollah, willing to take risk, being more concerned with who they believe themselves to be than being pragmatists, right? And so, like I said earlier, Hezbollah is the only force in the Middle East that has defeated the Israelis and made them withdraw. Something that's being repeated over and over again. I keep hearing it whenever I watch a different commentator. That's what they keep saying. And so that spirit, the reason for their existence, as well as to the population that witnesses and has witnessed for decades what Israel has done is capable of doing, that just makes it seem like it's going to be an organization more disposed for action, more disposed for risk, more disposed for just aggression. These are also men who aren't really that young anymore. I mean, the Syrian civil war was 12 years ago or so. 8 to 12 years ago or however long, I guess longer than that. but anyway, I think folks know what I mean. Like in a sense that these are not 19, 20 year olds. These are men who are in their 30s and 40s with real experience. Now, the problem with that experience is that it was not against an adversary that had the technology and the capabilities of Israel, particularly its air power, whether that be manned or drone or missile or what have you. Also, the electronic capabilities, as we've seen, right? No need to belabor that, how effective Israeli intelligence is in finding people and then killing them based upon their, you know, electronic signals, their you know, their phones and whatnot, you know. So the Hezbollah, of course, will learn that. But the idea that, you know, this is a different opponent is something that the Hezbollah has to really take into consideration, that their tactics, their procedures that they utilized in Syria may not be what's needed here against Israel in a ground war. At the same time, too, they have everything else on their side, though. And if they get that support from other nations and they get a boost of 20, 30,000, again, not just trained, but battlefield experienced, competent. And I say competent, I mean competent because they won their wars. We don't have many competent American commanders, I can tell you that. We've got none, you know, but certainly Hezbollah, the Yemenis, the Iraqis, the Syrians, they won their wars. You know, the Yemenis beat both the Saudis and UAE, who were backed by the Americans. So, you know, I mean, they have that competency, but again, they got to be careful about understanding who they're up against, Israel's abilities with its electronic intelligence and its air power, its drones, and how those are tied together. Just, you know, that is game changing in a lot of ways. And, you know, so this idea that Israel was going to beat Hezbollah into submission, I think, of course, is about as likely to work as beating Hamas into submission. What you do have, though, is within the Lebanese population, it's a population that's already been inflicted. You know, their economic crisis of several years ago, 80% of the Lebanese live in poverty. I mean, their money is just worthless. People have no money because it just evaporated when it was sitting in the banks, essentially, as well as all the other aspects of their financial and economic crisis. It's an incredibly poor, impoverished country. And for it to sustain and to take the blows that, say, the people in Gaza have been taking, you know, for what? For what reason? You know, that thought then can start percolating of like, why are we involved in this? This is not our war. This is, you know, and then there can be some, I think, against Hezbollah in a sense, in that way of like, you're the ones who did this to us, as well as then you have the other as well to the anger at, say, Iran. We're doing this in your behalf. Where are you? Why are you not supporting us? You know, you've seen some of that in some Middle Eastern publications. You know, how much that will actually weigh versus the idea, you know, the suffering, the pain, the hardship of the economic circumstances, the anger at the destruction brought to them. For what purpose? Why are we involved with this? Right? How much does that weigh against just the history of Lebanon? You know, in there you have to now take into the fact that I'm speaking as if Lebanon is a one singular entity, and it's not. I mean, we know that there are various factions, various sects throughout the country, and its government is nothing but a shell. The government is almost meaningless. You know, you have that, and then there's the third aspect of the history, though, particularly for those who support Hezbollah already, for the Shia Lebanese, of what Hezbollah was for. Why are we doing this? What is happening? Why are we helping the Palestinians? Why do we see them as our brothers and sisters in this? You know, I mean, all that, I think, are the three points on which support in Lebanon will, you know, hinge for Hezbollah and for unifying potentially against Israel. That's one thing that you're seeing coming out of this, Nima, is the possibility of a unification. And we've talked about this before, right? But this idea of a unification through the Middle East against Israel, you know, in a sense of you get the Turks, the Persians, and the Arabs on the same page here. You got Shia and Sunni. You're seeing that with Hezbollah and Hamas. We've seen that already for the last year, right? So this idea of Israel unifying, you know, the nations against them, is something that we haven't seen in 50 years. So, you know, that's a really another very important thing to factor as well, that any type of Arab nationalism, any type of Muslim nationalism, I guess, right, you know, that regional nationalism that, you know, will propel people into how they decide how are they going to support Hezbollah in this and whether or not they're going to continue that support. And my bet is that Hezbollah won't lose support. They'll gain some, but that it'll be a pretty fractured. The idea of Lebanon unifying under one banner for this, I don't think is very possible, if at all possible. And these other nations, I think you'll continue to see the axis of resistance grow stronger. They'll work more with nations like Turkey, you know, as well as then the nations that don't want to get their don't want to be involved in this, say Saudi Arabia. Are going to come under increased pressure to do something. And so at least not be actively supporting, but passively supporting, including, you know, do we want to do an oil embargo or something like that, right? Just to throw out the easy thing out there.
Yeah. And when you look at the way that Hezbollah together with Houthis were fighting Israel and the way that Israel is carrying out its operations, whenever we saw Hezbollah attacking Israel, they didn't attack the civilian part of Israel. They attacked the military bases, even Houthis. They're capable. We saw that they're capable to hit even the heart of Israel.
Right.
And but they didn't do that, Matt. And on the other hand, you see Israelis just Netanyahu talking about peace, 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 and just hitting in the same day that he's talking about attacking, just ordering the attack on Hezbollah. Why, in your opinion, how we can understand the strategy of Hezbollah, even Houthis, even with Iran? They don't want to attack civilians. On the other hand, you see Israelis are the opposite way.
Right.
And how we can understand these different, totally different behaviors on their parts?
Yeah, I mean, the Israelis certainly, they view civilian casualties as part of their war plan, the Dahiya plan, right? Which Dahiya is the suburb of, or the sorry, the section of Beirut that Israel pounded on Friday and killed Hassan Nasrallah, many other Hezbollah commanders, and of course a ton of innocent people, a ton of men, women, and children who their only crime was living there, right? I mean, like, so hundreds and hundreds killed. Well, more than 1,000 of them killed in the last week or two in Lebanon. And that's part of Israel's conduct. That's how they go to war. They exist in a, you know, I'm trying to avoid like a too theological of a comparison here, but, you know, and this isn't perfect, but they exist in a house of war, which is an Islamic term. Again, not really perfect for these circumstances, but I think particularly you put that in English language, American English language, the idea of a house of war, people understand of what that means, who these people are. Israel has always embraced terror for its military and political objectives. They've seen terror as part of those. So whether it was what occurs during a Nakba, whether it's what occurs you know, certainly in 67, the ethnic cleansing that takes place all throughout the last 120 years. And then, of course, not just their terror of the people of Palestine through the occupation and now this genocide, but, of course, what they've done to Lebanon in the past. I mean, when Israel invades Lebanon in 82, they essentially establish what state-run terrorism looks like. And they're exploding car bombs in Beirut. I mean, the massacres that their proxies carried out are massacres that will live forever. You know, they're so infamous. You know, so certainly the idea of the Israelis utilizing civilian casualties as part of their plan, as a goal of itself, because what we know also, too, is that Israel has Dahiya doctrine. Again, that's the part of Beirut they're bombing this weekend. And, you know, that comes from 06 when Israel did roughly the same thing, too, and destroyed entire residential blocks in an effort ostensibly to go after enemy commanders. But the real purpose is to put to visit punishment, to be brutal for no other purposes than punishment and brutality, the idea that this is what you do to your enemy. And whether or not the academics and the historians and the military experts will tell you that those types of campaigns don't work, all they do is harden resistance to you and your efforts and your occupation and so forth, it doesn't matter, because that's not the point. The point is just the brutality. The point is just the killing. This is what you do when you are faced with a subhuman race that you have to, and then you get back into all the historical aspects of this, whether it's the modern or the biblical, and it reinforces that. And so that's how the Israelis see it. I mean, certainly, then on the other side, it is interesting because the axis of resistance goes very much out of their way to avoid creating civilian casualties. Hezbollah rockets have killed Israeli citizens in the last year, but not many. Up until 2 weeks ago, I think it was like the ratio was 7 or 8 Lebanese killed for every Israeli killed, or something like that, and many more times wounded Lebanese than Israelis. But you know, this idea of why do they do that is a good one to explore. Is it a cultural religious thing? Certainly you can point to aspects of that, because there is, but they've also seen the brutality that these countries have taken part in particularly say the Syrian war, and there wasn't that restraint then. I think it may be more of a strategic, not doing anything that's going to prompt the Israelis to then turn to the Americans and they say, look what these people are doing. If you don't fight them here, you're going to have to fight them back in the U.S. That's how, on and on and on. Right. So that possibly is it. They know that if they hit a schoolhouse and this kill dozens of children and teachers, well, that might be enough for the American Congress to order the president to do something, or for the president to do something himself. Right. I mean, what happened back in late spring, early summer, when we don't even know whose missile it was, may have been Hezbollah, may have been Israeli, hit that Golan Heights village, and killed a dozen kids, I think, playing soccer. The outrage in the U.S. was tempered because those weren't Israelis; those were Druze. And as hard as the American media tried to avoid explaining the difference between Israelis and Druze, and that people of Golan are an occupied people, and vast majority of them reject the Israeli annex and they reject Israeli citizenship, the pressure wasn't there because those weren't Israelis; those kids didn't count. So there's that, and it's also too for keeping. I think as well, the propaganda war, the strategic information media war, you don't want bad stories like that. And I think that might play a role in a way that people don't understand, or people don't appreciate, that they may be as they may be susceptible to that, where they don't want other crunches around the world seeing anything that would give any degree of support for Israel because a hospital was just hit. But I think primarily it's to not create the type of casualty situation that would then play into what Israel wants and would put more pressure on the U.S. to be directly involved.
And if you remember, when they were attacking Gaza, and Netanyahu published a video message saying that we are not your enemy, your enemy is Hamas. And we're trying to kill them to save you, and it's unbelievable. And right now, he sent, before these attacks on Nasrallah, he sent a video message again talking to Lebanese people that your enemy is Hezbollah, is not us. And today he gave a new video talking to Iranians, the government in Iran. The question is, Matt, it seems that the way that he's implementing these attacks on civilians, he thinks that he can make some sort of insatisfaction, some sort of unrest within the society that may influence the government, that may people protesting against the government, just overthrowing the government, overthrowing Hezbollah. It's the level of intelligence, if they're thinking this way, the level of intelligence is unbelievable.
Yeah, right. I mean, and the Israelis have they don't believe it. This is what they feel they have to say to maintain the image. Some of it might be the madman theory. We're going to say one thing and do the exact opposite. I think a lot of it's because that's what the West expects. That's what Western trained public relations and media people will tell you to say. That's what the militaries will pretend to be in line with, that we are the option of last resort, and on and on and on. So those various things, yeah, I think explain. Also, too, it's helpful. I've not seen all of those videos, but the two I saw, unless I saw the same one twice. And I mean, he's saying kind of the same thing every time. But, he chooses to do them in English, right? Yeah. And of course, he doesn't. I don't know. I don't think he knows Arabic. Maybe he does. I don't know. Probably doesn't know Farsi, right? So how is he going to do that anyway? But the point is that, well, if that's the case, if they've got to translate it anyhow, just do it in Hebrew then. And of course, the image, of course, of him speaking Hebrew to those nations, I think would get a lot of people's hairs up, to put it mildly. But, just shows that I think the use of the English is primarily because it's directed to the West. It's directed to the United States media outfits, the corporate media outfits, and to the American Congress. And that's what he's most concerned about, keeping that support, keeping that injection, the continual positive air that keeps the Israeli balloon, full. So, I have to imagine that in Lebanon and in Iran, they were taking for essentially what they were, just as propaganda. And they were probably watched with some amusement and some interest. But, it's the idea that your actions are going to cause the Lebanese to, the Shia Lebanese to reject Hezbollah. That's going to work as well as people in Gaza rejecting Hamas, people in Palestine over the years rejecting the PLO. I believe after the conflict is over and time goes by, people can and will reject those institutions if they're able to, if they're allowed to, maybe not. But certainly when you've got that pressure, when you've put people into a corner where you're committing a genocide, them or in Lebanon's case, they're watching that, but they're also remember your own occupation of them, to think that people are going to, and this is the ultimate, this is like attempting to conduct divide and conquer within a constituency itself, within a sect itself. So it is much harder to divide and conquer that. And also, too, the results can be even more disastrous. So I don't know. I'm sure he'll put out more videos. He seems to like them. I don't know if you noticed, too, that when he gave his UN speech, they had the big walkout. And the gallery, the Israelis packed the gallery. And I watched a handful of speeches, five or six of those at least. And nobody has people in the gallery.
Is that common? That a lot of people.
I don't think so. People go up there, but the way the Israelis bust in people, obviously, and maybe they haven't taken the subway. I don't know, but they brought them in a large number, and they were very enthusiastic and the cheering. And of course, that cheering matches up with then all the sound bites that are going to get put out. So it makes people who aren't really aware of this that most of the General Assembly walked out on this guy. Sounds like he's getting support, right? So there's that. But then it's also, too, I think, an FU, a snub. But the joke, of course, is that who the Israelis packed that gallery with, well, to get that level of cheering, to get that little of slavish obsequience, you'd have to bring in the American Congress because the gallery did sound like the Congress when Netanyahu was here. Where this all goes, and it just keeps coming back to this idea of Netanyahu, getting political gain from it. And so that's why I think it keeps going.
Just to wrap up this session, Matt, do you think that Netanyahu is going to attack Iran?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think he understands that right now he's getting everything he wants from the Democrats, right? There really aren't asking for anything they're not getting. They're getting all the weapons and support. They're getting all the political support. They're getting diplomatic support. They're getting this cover about how we're working tirelessly for a ceasefire. Certainly the support that they got from the Americans, from both the president and the vice president, regarding their assassination of Nasrallah, the celebration of that by the American political and media elite. They've gotten everything they want. So it doesn't seem like Netanyahu needs to jerk Biden and Harris's chain in the next 5 weeks, because he's a politician. He is a pragmatist in that sense. He understands what that would do to them. If he was angry at them, maybe he would do that. If he wanted to make sure Trump would win. And as great as Trump is for the Israelis, Biden and Harris aren't too bad. So it's more likely then that the possibility is that he waits to after November 5th. And, you know, does something during that lame duck period, because here in the United States, people are outside. We have a period, the election's November 5th. The president won't be sworn in until around January 20th. So you have roughly 2.5 months of a very serious, what we call lame duck presidency. Joe Biden's essentially been one for most of his term in office, but most especially since he dropped out of the race back in the summer. So, you know, during that time, you have the ability, I think, for the Israelis to push something riskier than what they understand the American political system is willing to accept. You know, and at that point, it's also possible for Biden to get involved and hand off the problem to his successor. You know, and of course, there'll be a rationale for this. There'll be a reason for this. But the reality is that the Israelis can't do this without the Americans. And so until they get a good, full grasp that the Americans are going to go into this war with them, and everything that it entails, I think they'll hold off. I think what Netanyahu wants is the continual crisis, is the constant war, is the ongoing emergency. So war in itself with Iran, they have to know what they're going to do. They're going to march an Israeli army over to Iran and conquer it. You know what I mean? Like, it just ends up being a tit for tat, continually escalating series of attacks. So, I mean, the Israeli that seems like a good thing to keep going and just wait. You can wait out till after November. Besides, you have, you know, this Lebanon front to utilize, and then they can open up a front in Syria as well. They can do something in Syria rather than have to do something really hard against Iran. So they can keep just reeling this out, the Israelis, as long as the society and economy and their political system on the collapse, which is a possibility. But you also have to go back to Netanyahu's madman guys, and also the fact that the Israelis want civilian casualties. They want brutality for its own sake. You know, that is the end. It's just that punishment. It's just that the killing is the end for the Israelis. Okay, you factor that in. And okay, now maybe it's not so certain he'd wait until November 5th. I hope he certainly does. And I hope that something happens. But I got to tell you, my hope for most of this is non-existent. I know we're supposed to, if we breathe, we're supposed to hope. But I tell you, like, it's just, how does it get better for the Palestinians? I just don't, even if Israel collapses and you have like a failed state there, they're going to dole out so much punishment to the Palestinians in the process. Right. I mean, and so how does it get better? What's the hope? The best situation in Lebanon is that, contrary to everything I was saying about the political benefits of this, things back off and they just go back to firing rockets and missiles at each other kind of in a mild manner. You know, that's the best, you know, because that also entails so much risk as well. So yeah, my hope is between zero and limited on a lot of this.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Hey, thank you, Nima.